Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.
That, of course, is the astrophysicist Bill Withers singing his excellent song. I don't think it was clear at the time that that was about eclipses. We know now. And so this is a special episode of the Colin McEnroe Show. It is a special Harbinger episode of the Colin McEnroe Show. Part of possibly a Harbinger series that we will just, you know, do again and again. In fact, this episode could be a Harbinger of future Harbinger episodes. But in the first segment, we are actually going to talk about ways in which this eclipse, the eclipse on April 8th, may be a harbinger of certain actual things like traffic jams and power shortages. The power shortages thing is fascinating. And then in the second segment, we were going to talk about ancient times when the eclipse was sometimes regarded as a harbinger in northern Mesopotamia during the Assyrian Empire in the 10th century BC. They had a certain suspicion about what was going to happen. Well, I don't want to spoil it. Let's say they made a somewhat cynical adjustment. And then we're just going to go full-on crazy Harbinger at the end. We're going to talk about some of the conspiracy theories and wacky ideas that have surfaced in recent weeks about what is going to happen when the eclipse comes. All of these ideas, I want to emphasize so much, in the third segment, are incorrect. Even though one of them is from Alex Jones. And when has he ever been wrong about anything? All right, but let's begin here in the real world. To do that, we are going to be joined by our first guest here. That is Vahe Perumian, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Southern California's Dornsife College of Arts, Letters, and Sciences. Sometimes refers to himself as a space scientist, which is, I think, a little, you know, easier for people to think about, and has written extensively not only about things like eclipses, but also about people's interest in seeing them, the so-called field of astrotourism. So, Vahe Perumian, welcome to our show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, we should just sort of begin with the idea that for some reason, in a way that I don't think compares evenly with 2017, there one senses a level of excitement about this particular eclipse that we maybe haven't seen before. But 2017 can teach us certain things. One thing that it can teach us, and please help me flesh this out, is that these are events in which people want to position themselves in the path of the so-called totality. Maybe first of all, explain what totality means, and then a little bit about why people want to be there.
Definitely. So during a solar eclipse, the moon is going to be partially or completely covering the disk of the sun. And so totality refers to the locations on Earth where the moon's shadow falls. And looking at the sun from that point of view, you're going to have the entire disk of the sun covered by the moon. And so the sky will go completely dark. So totality refers to that very thin sliver on the surface of the Earth where the moon completely blocks our view of the sun. And it is, you know, as everyone has been saying for the last week, even a 99% eclipse is very different than a total eclipse. So if you're somewhere where you're looking at online resources and they're telling you that you're not going to get a total eclipse, you will have a very different experience from those who are actually in the path of totality.
Yeah, I mean, I was having a hard time wrapping my mind around that, although our producer, McCusker, did find an Andy Dillard quote, "Seeing a partial eclipse bears the same relation to seeing a total eclipse as kissing a man does to marrying him." I was pretty good friends with Andy's third husband, so I kind of get where that comes from. But here in Connecticut, I don't know, we're like 93% of totality. To me, that sounds pretty good. 93% Sounds pretty good. I was surprised that people thought, no, I got to get to northern New Hampshire immediately. But I guess there really is a difference worth talking about.
Yeah, there definitely is. For example, I happened to make it to the annular eclipse, which was in October of 2023. And in an annular eclipse, the moon is positioned in a way that it blocks out most, 99% of the sun, but it's too small to cover the entire disk. So you're seeing 1% of the sun. And that is already too bright to look at. And it's a very different experience than having the entire sun blocked, for it to get completely dark everywhere, for you to see a 360-degree sunset. So yes, there is, as you said, is the differences between kissing and marrying. It is that big a difference.
And I would, just to maybe even convey in an auditory way the excitement that people experience at something like this, we're going to hear a crowd in Salem, Oregon in 2017 react to the moment when the moon's shadow obscures the sun during the 2017 total solar eclipse. A1, Kat. They seem very happy. Maybe you have a theory about why there would be, you know, this sort of applause, like, way to go, moon, I guess. Nice work, moon. But people get very excited about this. I don't know. Do you have any theories about why?
I think because it's such a rare and once-in-a-lifetime event. And honestly, nothing comes close to it in terms of what you can usually observe. You know, even if you go to the darkest skies on Earth and observe the night sky and see hundreds, if not thousands, of stars, even if you see the Milky Way with your naked eyes, it's nothing to compare with having it be daytime. And what starts happening is, as the sun is being obscured, it gets darker and darker. But at the moment of totality, you start noticing things like how quiet as it has become. Of course, if you're in a crowd like the one you play, the video, the sound that you played, of course you're not going to be hearing the quiet for too long. But when I happened to be at Bryce Canyon for the annular eclipse, and it was just like there's a hush over the landscape. You know, the birds stop singing. You know, it gets dark enough for even crickets to start chirping, thinking it's night. And so it's a surreal experience that I think then excites people that they're sharing this moment with everyone around them. So I'm not a psychologist. I'm a scientist, but I think having been with people during an eclipse and just looking around and seeing how different people were absorbing that experience, I can fully understand the excitement.
You're not only a space scientist, you're also kind of a sky enthusiast. And I'm wondering if there's any tiny little ungenerous part of your soul in which you think, wow, people get all wound up about this stuff like once every 7 years, or it's going to be longer before the next one. But almost every week, there's something in the night sky. You know, I mean, you write about this, that you sometimes with your son travel to all kinds of locations where there's not a lot of light pollution. I mean, there's a lot of stuff besides eclipses that people could, if they wanted to, fill up their time with.
That's certainly true. And I think what's happened is maybe the 2017 eclipse started this or added to it. I'm seeing a little bit more interest in, you know, more coverage perhaps of meteor showers, or just a couple of days ago, you know, all of a sudden we had a Chinese satellite re-enter Earth's orbit over LA. And so a whole bunch of people saw it, took videos, and all the news coverage was about what is this in our sky. So I think people are paying a lot more attention to whether it's a transient event like that or astrotourism, where they travel to see the northern lights, they travel to see the Milky Way, or meteor showers. And I maybe my news feed is biased, but I am seeing more mentions of this in social media. And I think I'm hoping that this eclipse will also boost interest in other astronomical events and in astronomy in general.
So one thing that we know and that you have cautioned people about is that it will definitely boost traffic. People are going to try to get to the totality. And we do know a little bit about this from, or maybe a lot about it from 2017. Say a little bit about what you see, maybe what you want people to understand about what may happen if 5 million people want to be in the same place at the same time.
Right. I think, you know, there's, you know, the advice is arrive early and stay put. So if it's cloudy where you are, or if it's partly cloudy, don't think that you're going to get into your car and zoom away to some location that may not be cloudy. Don't do that, because you're putting yourself in danger. A paper came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association a couple of weeks ago that said that during the 2017 eclipse, there was an extra crash every 25 minutes and an extra fatal crash every 90 minutes during the time of the eclipse. So we're talking about when the eclipse began to when it ended, not just the time of totality. And there were like 700 fatalities during that day, extra. So we're talking about putting yourself in danger if you are still on the road, or thinking of moving to a different location, or thinking of maybe even looking at the eclipse while you're driving. So all of these are very dangerous behaviors that I'm going to discourage. So find a spot. If there's traffic, pull over. You know, it's not worth your life to observe this event. There will be other ones. Yes, the next one is a couple of decades away, but it's not worth endangering your life for it. So I would say, if you haven't made plans yet of how to get there and when to get there, leave as early as possible, find a spot and stay there. And especially right after the eclipse, don't rush back as soon as the eclipse ends. That's what a lot of people do. And you know, during the annular eclipse in October, when I actually experienced the crowds in Bryce Canyon, the best thing I did was say, you know what, I'm going to stay here and I'm going to have lunch first. I'm going to let everybody empty out, and then I'm going to hit the road. Because otherwise, you're dealing with everyone trying to leave that area, and you know, people that are probably late arriving and so on. So I would say staying put is the best advice I could give to anyone.
And another thing to acknowledge is that if you haven't made plans to find a place to stay by now, you may be in trouble. I was looking last night at a sort of a visual representation of data that showed the Airbnbs that are currently booked in America. And there's like this big red stripe that is identical to the path of the totality. So clearly other people thought about this before you did, maybe, you know,
right,
just face that fact. Yeah, and no, the thing that I really found astonishing, and it's sort of good news and it's sort of bad news. The good news is that we have engaged in the long wished for conversion toward solar power, toward solar energy, in a much to be desired way. And there's going to be even more of this. We're on a good track for even more of this. And solar power is a wonderful thing in terms of climate change. It is a great answer. However, that maybe the one tiny little exception would be during a total eclipse. So tell us more about that.
Sure. A study was done about the 2017 eclipse, and we were actually prepared for that eclipse because of the experience the European power grid had during their 1999 eclipse. So what happens during a solar eclipse is you're going to be losing solar power, not just in the large scale power generation stations, but on households that depend on solar power as well. So you have to anticipate that there's going to be this power loss. And for example, for Monday's eclipse, the estimate just for the state of Texas, where the path of totality starts in the US, is that they're going to lose something like 15 gigawatts of power. So each gigawatt powers about 750,000 homes. So you can think about the power loss that they're going to be experiencing. And there's two other factors that contribute to this. First of all, it's a pretty rapid power loss as the eclipse begins. So the electrical transmission grid is going to be taxed, because you have to have alternate power sources online. For example, if you're replacing solar with natural gas power plants or coal fire plants, which they did during the 2017 eclipse, you have to then transmit that power to local substations. And so power transmission becomes an issue. A rule has been put in place, for example, that grids will stay local. They will not transmit long distance, so that transmission lines aren't taxed by the eclipse. Now, one of the things that's taken into account is, you know, cloudy skies. Obviously, at any time during, you know, over the U.S., some portion of the U.S. is cloudy. And so this is, you know, tied into all of the models that electrical grid operators use to see how much solar power they can generate and how what other power sources they need. So that's been factored in. But an eclipse is an additional challenge because it presents a very rapid loss of solar power. And in places that depend on wind power, actually, you know, because the temperature can drop as much as 10 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to also get winds to die down. So your wind power is also lost. And so you have to replace your two top renewable energy sources with fossil fuels that are being burned at that time.
Yeah, you wrote that the 2017 eclipse led to approximately 10 million pounds of extra carbon dioxide emissions. Now, that's about the annual carbon dioxide emissions of 1,000 cars. So it's sort of funny. I mean, because we've done things that are good for the environment, the eclipse is kind of bad for the environment.
Right, and this time we have three times the power, the solar power generation capacity that we did in 2017. So it's going to be three times worse.
One thing that I've wondered is, I mean, my sense is that the enthusiasm right now is even higher than what I remember from 2017. It's a hard thing to measure, obviously, but just looking out there on social media and just anecdotally talking to people, This is something that's way outside your area of specialization, so I'm doing an unfair thing by asking you your opinion about this. But I'm wondering whether particularly young people, millennials and Zoomers, because they've spent quite a bit of their lives in sort of virtual or digital reality, whether things that happen in the real world even have a higher level of excitement. Like, wow, this is not happening on my phone or my laptop. This is not happening on TikTok. It's happening in the sky. I'm wondering if that might be one of the reasons, anyway, we're seeing the kind of excitement that seems to be out there.
You know, that might be the case, but also, you know, what social media has brought to us is, you know, think about what's happening, for example, to our national parks or any picturesque scene around the world, that, you know, all you need is one influencer to take a picture of themselves that do a selfie there, and you have hundreds of people descending on that location to take the exact same picture. So an event like this, where people know that their friends or people they follow on social media are going to be present and are going to be doing a live stream or going to take a selfie of themselves with the eclipse sun, that attracts some of the younger generation to want to duplicate that experience. And this is not something that, okay, I can see it today on social media, and then 10 days later I can go take the picture. You have to be there at that same time. And I think that might be driving some of the interest. And also, I think that the 2017 eclipse generated so much interest that the people who missed out on the 2017 eclipse are now saying, okay, I don't want to miss this other chance, because after that, it's not 6 years. The next eclipse to go across the U.S. is 2044.
Right. The young people call this FOMO, fear of missing
FOMO,
out.
FOMO, exactly.
So one last thing that we theoretically or ideally shouldn't have to tell people. I'm 69 years old. I've been hearing this since I was a child. However, let's say it. And let's not only say it, but let's show it with one of our greatest Americans, Marge Simpson, watching an eclipse. This is a two cat.
Oh, I can't miss out. Just one little peek. It's beautiful.
That is because Marge took off her protective eyewear, which a certain president of the United States also elected to do in 2017. You're not an eye doctor, but you could tell them not to do this.
Absolutely. So staring at the sun at any time is going to be dangerous for your eyes. Now, if it's partially eclipsed, you might think, oh, there's less sunlight coming through, and so I can look at it. But what you're doing is you're damaging your eye. If you're looking through a camera, you're damaging your camera lens. You're possibly amplifying the amount of light that's getting to your eye. So do not take off your eclipse glasses. You can do that during totality, but the only danger there is not anticipating when totality is going to end and getting that blast of sunlight at the end. And make sure you have proper eclipse glasses. I've heard of certain places selling counterfeit glasses, which are not going to work. Make sure you get your glasses from a reputable source. If you haven't gotten them already, maybe look for, you know, a library or a local organization that's giving them out, because it is crucial to have eclipse glasses when you're looking at the sun during the eclipse.
Yes. Don't buy the Acme protective glasses that a Wile E. Coyote wears. They don't work. All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for all of this. And oh, one last thing. Okay. This plays right into your strengths. I mean, okay, people are going to do the eclipse, or they're not going to do the eclipse, or maybe it's going to be cloudy, or who knows. I mean, suggest one thing that might be coming up in the next 2 or 3 months. Could be the night sky, something in the night sky, something that you would really recommend that people who like, who find out they like looking up instead of looking down at their phones, what else could they look up at in the near future?
So we have several meteor showers that happen during the year. And you know, there's a very prominent meteor shower in August. You have to make sure that the moon's not out. So if there's a full moon or any moon in the sky, you're not going to see it properly. But the, you know, the August meteor shower is a good one. And then eclipses usually happen in a cadence of every 6 months, not necessarily at the same location, but we do have a couple of lunar eclipses coming up. And so, you know, if you've never seen a lunar eclipse, these last a lot longer, about hour and a half, and they can be seen from the night side of the earth. So that's everyone. You don't have to travel for it. All you have to do is look up. So I would say, if you get interested in astronomical phenomena, keep an eye out on meteor showers, keep an eye out on lunar eclipses, which are a lot easier to observe.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Vahe Perumian, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Southern California's Dom Seif College of Arts, Letters, and Sciences. We're going to take a little break. We're going to talk after that about other kinds of harbingers, harbingers suggested by harbinger mongers who are perhaps less solid in their science.
There's nothing I can do, a total eclipse of the heart.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Black hole sign, won't you come? Won't you wait?
That, of course, is an ancient Mesopotamian hymn. Here to talk about such things is Rebecca Boyle, a science journalist and author of the book Our Moon, How Earth's Celestial Companion Transformed the Planet, Guided Evolution, and Made Us Who We Are. And it's possible, Rebecca Boyle, that you right now are at some kind of eclipse conference, possibly in Arkansas or something like that, right?
Tomorrow morning, I will be there.
Yes,
right now, I'm still home. But yeah.
Apparently, originally, the publisher of Atlas Obscura was going to speak in your spot, and you were suddenly elevated with no explanation. So One quick good question. Anytime something like that happens, Rebecca, I think you and I both agree, you should ask somebody, is this Sharpuhi? Is this a Sharpuhi kind of thing? Because if it is, you don't want to do it. I don't even know if I said that right. It's surprising how much ancient Assyrian is not on Duolingo. You know, you just, they don't really do it very well.
You have to make a lot of guesses. I think it's like Sharpuhi or something like that. I don't know.
That sounds so much like something else. But we're toying with the audience right now. They're wondering what in the world we're talking about. So explain the somewhat cynical solution that a group of ancient priests came up with to a certain kind of prophecy connected to the eclipse.
Yeah. So, and this is like one of my favorite kind of stories from antiquity, when people weren't sure what eclipses actually were and they were really terrified by them, which makes a certain kind of sense because like the sun vanishing in the middle of the day for no reason is kind of freaky. And as you heard that audio, people, even in modern times when we know exactly what's happening, are kind of like overwhelmed. So it makes sense to me that people would come up with rituals to describe what's happening or like protect themselves. But this one is a little bit more spicy, I guess. The substitute king ritual dates to, it lasted for several hundred years, actually, in the Assyrian Empire in ancient Mesopotamia, which is like what's now Iraq and parts of Syria. People in this area were really fixated on eclipses because they were really fixated on the moon and the sun and what they were doing and what that meant. And so there was this prophecy that said if a solar eclipse or a lunar eclipse actually were to happen, that it would mean something really terrible is going to, you know, befall the king or the whole kingdom. There could be an invasion of a foreign army, or the king is going to die. So they invented this ritual called the substitute king, in which if the astrologers foretold a bad eclipse, in which like Jupiter was visible maybe, or it rose over a certain part of the land, the king would die. So they would go pick somebody else to dress as the king, like a doppelganger, and put him in the palace and have feasts and ceremonies and all these different events. And the real king would go and hide somewhere in peasant clothing and hang out. And this lasted for sometimes a couple of days, sometimes up to a month before the actual eclipse. And then when the eclipse happened, the substitute king would be killed, usually by drinking poison, like drinking poison hemlock tea or something. And that would fulfill the prophecy of regicide, but the actual king didn't have to be the one to die.
Well, it either would or wouldn't fulfill the prophecy of regicide. I mean, it's assuming that the celestial powers in charge of all this are really stupid and very easily duped. It's like, well, looks like the king to us. Guess he better die. Oh, he's already dead. Somebody else killed him. I guess our work is done here.
They were satisfied.
It was a hopeful gesture more than, I think, you know, a dead certainty that this would work. But who can know? We should say that, obviously, finding somebody who would be willing to do this might be somewhat difficult. I certainly would be going, you know what? My pita stand at the marketplace is really taking off right now. I'm getting long lines. There's no way I can be substitute king, but thank you so much for asking. Thank you for thinking of me. Quite frequently, the best solution was to find someone who essentially had no choice.
It was probably going to be like a political prisoner, maybe, or somebody that, you know, the society would not notice their absence quite so much.
The upside of this, assuming that it could be understood to have an upside, would be the fact that they believed all this, I assume, meant that they got really good at record keeping and maybe trying to figure out when these things were going to happen. Because since there are, you know, pretty substantial consequences, you kind of want to know when they're coming.
Yeah, I mean, this is that we owe a lot to the Babylonians and the Akkadians and the Assyrians, all these people and empires who lived in this part of the world. This is the cradle of civilization, and we owe a lot to them, but especially astronomy. Like, the first real science on Earth happens because of these superstitions, which is what we'd call them now. But at the time, these were really important things to be able to predict. And so they got very good at doing that, and they kept really detailed records over, I mean, literally millennia, you know, of what the moon was doing, where it was, what planets were nearby, when they were rising and setting, how those things changed over time. when eclipses happened and what time they happened and when and where they happened over the land. And those have been still actually very useful for modern scientists to go back and figure out how things in the heavens have changed.
You know, the other part about this that was clear from reading your article is that although since this happened over, you know, multiple times over a long period of time, it happened different ways. And might have been done, I'm talking about the substitute king thing, might have been done in a fairly perfunctory way. But sometimes they really went Daniel Day-Lewis on this, right? I mean, they really kind of, you know, had a substitute king who was just doing a lot of king stuff and had staff and maybe a virginal queen or something. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the substitute king gets to basically live like the king, you know, and have wonderful feasts and be dressed in really wonderful clothing and woven robes, probably. And then there are stories of concubines who were presented to him. And, you know, he gets to kind of live like a royal for a while until it all comes to a very sad ending.
I do want to say, this is a courtesy of our producer, McCusker, the Whiz Kid, that the Assyrian capital city where the substitute king would have been killed was apparently Nineveh, which is the subject of a lot of conspiracy theories that we'll be talking about in the next segment, because there turned out to be a lot of places in America called Nineveh. and so brace yourselves, people from Nineveh. I mean, you kind of went down a little bit of a rabbit hole with all this stuff. You looked at other beliefs about the eclipse. Like, I think in ancient Chinese myth, there's a dragon that's going to eat the sun. Is that what it is?
Yeah, this is one of the stories from ancient China that, an evil dragon is going to devour the sun. It's a really similar story in Inca mythology, actually, that there's like a dragon or some kind of beast that's eating the sun. There's one legend that it was a squirrel that's going to eat the sun. There's a lot of like mythology around something consuming the sun because it's going away. And like, what else, you know, could describe that? Like, people didn't understand that there were these celestial mechanics at play. So it was like, something is eating it or it's going to die. You know, one of my favorite more modern myths is the Navajo today. People in the Southwest talk about the death of the sun. So the sun is literally like passing away, it has to be reborn during a total eclipse. And so they don't watch it. A lot of schools and businesses will be closed on Navajo land on Monday because it's considered a really sacrilegious act to watch a solar eclipse.
Yeah, I'm sort of hashtag Navajo curious as a result of reading. I read up more articles about that. There's also just huge tax advantages. But yeah, I mean, I like the idea that they're the people who are not going to look at the eclipse. They are going to sit quietly in their homes for about 4 hours. They're going to abstain from food and water. They're not going to bathe or comb their hair or sleep. It's going to be, you know, this very abstemious kind of holiday, but it's not the super negative one either. It's
very reverent. It's like a very, yeah, very spiritual kind of meditative ceremony.
I like that so much better than driving, you know, through a traffic jam and then shotgunning Red Bull and getting all, you know, wound up about this whole thing. It just seems way healthier. I just want to come back to the Chinese thing for a second. I think the squirrel thing was probably a transcription error. There was probably a scroll that said the squirrels will eat your sunflowers, so your sunflower seeds, you know, and it just got abbreviated to sun.
That could be.
I'm guessing. It's just like somebody spilled something on the parchment. So, I mean, as we get ready to wrap up here, although I could talk about this for a great deal longer, but there is sort of a common thread, right? That this is a time of awe. You know, I think for ancient civilizations, the awe was, what the hell is happening? But it stays with us that there's something going up in the sky that we have no power of, and it seems like it's pretty important.
I think it's impossible to overhype what this experience is like. Like in the 2017 eclipse, I wrote about it a lot. I was just in the very early stages of trying to write the proposal for this book. And I was kind of very immersed in eclipse facts and mythology. And I was like, okay, I'll go watch it and, you know, we'll see it. It'll be cool. And I was blown away. And I mean, people near me were crying and screaming and, you know, the cicadas and all the katydids and the summer Midwest insects came out, and it was dark. I mean, it was like, you know, nighttime, and the whole experience was just very sensorially overwhelming. And I think that's how people have probably felt for all of time. And so it'll be really fun to see what the modern human reaction is. But I was going to say, I was happy that you were talking earlier about not watching this through your phone. And you know, this is a thing we can all experience, just like all of humanity who has been, you know, has had sight, has seen these events through all of time. So it's a cool thing that connects us to everyone who's ever lived here, and we can all enjoy it without being on TikTok or Instagram.
Rebecca Boyle, that was very well said. We're very excited about the new book, Our Moon, How Earth's Celestial Companion Transformed the Planet, Guided Evolution, and Made Us Who We Are. We'll probably be in touch in the future for more about that. But Rebecca Boyle, thanks. Science journalist who wrote about this for Atlas Obscura. Atlas Obscura, which we love, we've always loved. They're really kind of pooping their pants about the eclipse at this point. I mean, they just can't, they can't publish enough articles about it. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. We'll be in touch. We're going to take a little break. We're going to come back. We're going to tell you about some other harbingers that are definitely, you know what? These are harbingers that are just not going to be harbinging.
All episodes of The Colin McEnroe Show are available 24/7 at ctpublic.org/Colin, which is also where you can sign up for our delightful free fortnightly newsletter, The Nose Letter. You can listen to any episode on any podcast app. Have a question or comment? Email us at colinshow@ctpublic.org. Now, back to the show.
And we are back. Our technical producer today is Kat Pastor. The producer of this episode was McCusker, is McCusker, the Wonder Kid, and her bad cat, Penelope. Penelope, by the way, pronounces Harbinger, Harbinger, like it's like Humdinger or something like that. That's wrong. So Penelope, just another strike against you. All right. Here to talk now about conspiracy theories. Well, before I say that, obviously there are some beliefs that, although they may be not be grounded in absolute scientific facts, you know, clearly have the ring of scientific authority. Here's a clip from the excellent documentary, Bloody Birthday. Be one, Cat.
1970, three children were born during a total eclipse of the sun. Now, 10 years later, they share a terrible compulsion to kill, and no one can stop them.
So might just want to extend your labor or something, you know, if it's happening on Monday. Leah Hudson-Leva is joining us now, a writer who researched conspiracy theories about this year's total eclipse for Atlas Obscura, the aforementioned and much beloved Atlas Obscura, is joining us now. So first of all, welcome to our welcome to our conversation.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So in a way, it feels at times, to me anyway, as we're living in a conspiracy-saturated culture that is now, I mean, there are always conspiracy theories and conspiracy myths, but they are now algorithmically driven and distributed. They can get to more people. You can find people who are more likely to believe in them. So you spent some time looking at eclipse conspiracy theories, and YouTube, TikTok, alternative social medias are a great way to spread these things. You kind of settled, I think, on three, and let's talk about the one that involves the poor people of Carbondale, Illinois.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you're right that it seems like conspiracy theories and conspiracy thinking are really prevalent these days. They have been a part of our history for a very long time. It's just with social media, it gives the appearance that they spread much more quickly and that they're more widespread. Whether or not that's actually true, there's not enough data really yet to determine, but it's definitely front of mind, I think, for a lot of people in the media. And this year with the eclipse, as you said, there have been three theories floating around. Carbondale in Illinois is basically the spot where the eclipse, the path of totality for the eclipse this year and the path of totality for the eclipse that happened in 2017, Carbondale is approximately where these two pathways cross and they form an X shape over the country. And this happens to be in the same place as the New Madrid seismic zone. So there have been theories floating around that essentially this eclipse will somehow set off this seismic zone and trigger a large earthquake. So this is a little bit more in the doomsday prediction zone than conspiracy theory per se. And it is connected with the second theory as well, which has to do with Nineveh, which you already mentioned. Basically, there's two theories that are somewhat connected, and then one that is more classic conspiracy theory to do with Alex Jones and InfoWars. So this earthquake prediction is somewhat linked to the other theory that the eclipse, the pathway of totality, will pass over seven cities in the United States, all called Nineveh. The question of whether there are even seven cities called Nineveh is also up for debate. I mean, this has been debunked to a certain extent that, you know, Wikipedia only lists six cities, and some of these aren't necessarily really cities. They are areas, but it's linked to a biblical city called Nineveh, which was basically subject to God's wrath in the Bible for being a wicked city. And the conspiracy theory or the biblical prophecy belief that is floating around is essentially that the US or the world as a whole is going in the wrong direction, and that the eclipse passing over Nineveh seven times, as well as other places like Rapture, is signaling doom is coming. And the earthquake in this New Madrid seismic zone is the way it's going to happen.
Right. You know, and I want to emphasize, and I know that you want to emphasize as well. I mean, I've been looking at conspiracy theories for decades and decades, and it's a little bit easy to become supercilious about them, to somehow or other feel superior to the people who embrace them, to maybe look down on those people. But I mean, I don't know. It's there's a human impulse to do this. And these people are sometimes misled by people with a little bit more power and reach than they have. But that doesn't necessarily make these people fools or knaves, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there is this narrative that conspiracy theorists are not very smart, or that conspiracy theorists are super paranoid, or you know, anything along these lines. But quite a bit of research has been done that has found that conspiracy theorists, the belief in conspiracy theories is not actually pathological. Anyone is susceptible to this kind of thinking. And they've done, I mean, psychologists have done studies and found, for example, that when you increase people's level of anxiety or increase their feeling of social isolation, they are more likely to believe in conspiracy theories. And that during times of social upheaval, during times of crisis, conspiracy thinking is more likely to thrive. And this is because when people have an underlying feeling of anxiety, or they feel like they are not being served by the systems that they are interacting with, conspiracy theories start to perform a kind of psychological function for them. There are three parts to that. So, for example, when things are uncertain, people like to gather knowledge. And sometimes the quality of the knowledge that they gather is not very good, but the gathering of knowledge anyway gives them a feeling of more certainty, where, you know, you think an earthquake is going to happen, then you can prepare for it in some way. And the certainty of the knowledge of that bad thing is more comfortable than complete uncertainty. So this is one function that it can perform. It can also help people meet a need they have for safety and control. Like, they feel this sense of preparedness, this feeling that maybe they can take action in response. And third, it can be a self-esteem thing that, you know, if you are already in some way feeling disempowered, once you start gathering this knowledge that feels like secret knowledge or knowledge that other people don't know, you can feel better. You can feel like you know something about the world that other people don't. As I said, the quality of the knowledge or the quality of the information that they're gathering is this kind of weak point, or the logic from that point starts to get really faulty. but the psychological mechanism that it has started from is, in a certain way, you know, we have it all within us when things are in a state of crisis. And when I look at the world right now, and I also look at the level of political division in the United States, for example, if you think about the different crises we have, you know, especially that we've just been through, COVID pandemic stuff, where conspiracy theories really started getting out of control. We've got wars going on. Technology is developing so fast. I think there's a kind of crisis of trust in a way, because everything is really changing so quickly. And I mean, I read somewhere, I think it was a Pew Research survey, that around 25% of people in the United States feel like we're living in the end times. So people aren't feeling good. They're not feeling like things are going well for them necessarily. And this leads people towards these beliefs. So while you can delve into the content of the beliefs, and while you might have this instinct to poke fun at people and say, how could anybody believe this? It actually makes a lot of sense when you put it in context and you look at our psychological makeup as humans and how we respond to things in our world.
Right. And right at the end of this conversation, we're going to talk about somebody who I believe intentionally preys upon all of those three impulses that you just described for his own enrichment. But it's also true, one thing that I noticed getting ready for this is that there are always kind of fragments of information floating around digital spaces, and it's pretty easy to see people attach stuff to them. For example, I read a couple of places that the Large Hadron Collider, the supercollider at CERN, is going to be doing something on April 8th and something unusual, or starting back up or whatever. And I kept noticing that none of the places I was reading this were particularly reputable or heavily fact-checked. I finally went on the CERN website. It didn't look like they're doing anything all that different from what they usually do. I mean, what they usually do is kind of freaky, but I don't think they're doing anything unusual. And there was also a thing about how NASA is going to shoot three rockets into the eclipse. This is not true. I went on the NASA website. What they are doing, which is kind of interesting, is they're sending three very specialized jets, their WB-57 jets, up above 50,000 feet up. So there'll be no possibility of cloud cover. And they just want to be able to take measurements of the eclipse and during the eclipse. But they're not doing anything weird. All right. So we have just a few minutes left, and that's all that Alex Jones and InfoWars really deserve. But he has been pushing a different idea. Leah, tell us about that.
Yeah. So that's the last conspiracy theory, which I'd say is more of a classic conspiracy theory, while the other two are more a doomsday perspective. The Alex Jones thing relates to the infrastructure issues, which you talked about at the beginning of this hour. Basically, some areas in the United States have called for a state of emergency in advance, or they've called for the support of the National Guard because of concerns of overwhelm and having large crowds gathering in certain places that might not be equipped to deal with those crowds. Alex Jones has put out the idea that actually this is a trial run for the government to implement quite high levels of control so that they can eventually enact martial law in the United States. And then it's connected to a larger conspiracy about the New World Order, which gets extremely extremely complicated. It's basically distrust of the government. And this is the direction that it comes from. It's typically more right-wing political perspectives that are, of course, already starting from this viewpoint that, you know, less government is better. So the conspiracy takes, I think, this infrastructure concern and the precautionary response. And as you say, there are all kinds of things that are happening, you know, to do with NASA or to do with CERN, but conspiracy theories in this case also are drawing conclusions from coincidences. They're drawing conclusions from one event and taking it further than what it really is. And so the Alex Jones thing is looking at what I consider to be a relatively responsible government response to large crowds and assuming that there's a much larger malicious intent behind that act.
Okay, we're going to have to stop there, but fine, fine work by you, Aaliyah Hudson-Leva, a writer who's researched conspiracy theories about this year's total eclipse for Atlas Obscura. We have to say goodbye, and remember, the eclipse will eventually be over, and guess what will happen after that?